From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 17 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition of NIH Research Radio, we welcome our new correspondent, Cherry Graziosi, as she sits down for a chat with Dr. Crystal Makel, chief of the immunology section and acting branch chief of the pediatric oncology branch of the National Cancer Institute. Wally Akinso shares a report about how bipolar disorder affects the workplace at the bottom line. Americans accustomed to the seasonal misery of sneezing, runny noses, and itchy, watery eyes caused by ragweed pollen may one day benefit from an experimental allergy treatment that not only requires fewer injections, but also leads to a marked reduction in symptoms. We'll tell you about the research. The National Eye Institute is looking into whether a modified combination of vitamins, minerals, and fish oil can further slow the progression of vision lost to age-related macular degeneration. And Wally will tell us about the new high blood pressure segment you can find on the NIH Senior Health website. But first, it's the largest long-term study into the health of America's Hispanic population. I'll have details when NIH Research Radio continues. Aristotle had this problem, so did Thomas Jefferson, and they went on to do great things. If you stutter, you could do something great too by participating in a National Institutes of Health stuttering study. Participants will be compensated, travel assistance is available, and all study-related tests are provided at no cost. Call 866-999-5553 or visit clinicaltrials.gov. Do something great. The NIH is a nonprofit government agency of the Department of Health and Human Services. The Hispanic population is the largest minority group in the United States. It's expected to triple in growth by 2050. And now, seven groups within the National Institutes of Health will fund the largest long-term epidemiological study of health and disease in Latin American populations living in the U.S. As many as 16,000 participants of Hispanic origin will undergo a series of physical exams and interviews to help identify the prevalence and risk factors for a wide variety of diseases, disorders, and conditions. The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute is the primary funding agency for this study, along with the National Center for Minority Health and Health Disparities, the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders, the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research, the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and the NIH Office of Dietary Supplements. In line with the recommendations of a 2003 NHLBI report on epidemiological research in Hispanic populations, the study will recruit people who identify themselves as Hispanics or Latinos, but will emphasize Mexican Americans, Cuban Americans, and Central or South Americans. Dr. Larissa Aviles Santa of NHLBI's epidemiology branch said the study will look at the role of cultural adaptation and disparities in the prevalence and development of disease among these groups in the Hispanic community.
For the first time, we are going to be able to compare all the groups, if possible, at once and follow them and truly look at the outcomes and discern or determine if there is any difference among them or not.
The Hispanic Community Health Study will address a variety of conditions, including heart disease, stroke, asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, sleep disorders, dental disease, hearing impairment and tinnitus, diabetes, kidney and liver disease, and cognitive impairment. The study will assess such risk factors as diet, physical activity, obesity, smoking, blood pressure, blood lipids, acculturation, social and economic disparity, psychosocial factors, occupation, healthcare access, the environment, and medication and supplement use. The NIH has awarded contracts totaling $60 million over 6.5 years for this study, which will take place at sites in New York City, Miami, San Diego, and Chicago. There's a brand new segment about hypertension on a popular NIH website. Wally Akinso has the details.
High blood pressure is often called the silent killer because in many cases the symptoms are silent. Most people who have high blood pressure aren't aware of it until it causes other health problems. High blood pressure, also known as hypertension, is a major health risk for older Americans. If it isn't treated, it can lead to stroke, heart disease, kidney failure, and other serious health problems. You can learn more about hypertension and its related conditions when you check out the high blood pressure topic on the website nihseniorhealth.gov. According to Dr. Ed Rochella, coordinator of the National High Blood Pressure Education Program at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, one way to control high blood pressure is with lifestyle changes.
If I were a much older American, first thing I would do is go to my doctor to be sure to have my blood pressure measured. People need to know their blood pressure in numbers, not words, in numbers. You don't want to hear your blood pressure is okay. What is the number? Then working with your doctor, there's a number of different ways to develop lifestyle plans that could help prevent the rise of blood pressure, even have blood pressures fall. Walking 30 minutes a day most days of the week is pretty good advice for most Americans, not only for blood pressure, but to just get up and around and to burn calories. It even helps for older Americans. Cutting back on excessive calories would be helpful. If you're overweight, lose weight. If you drink more than 2 drinks a day for men and 1 for women, you might consider cutting back on excessive alcohol. A diet in fresh fruits and vegetables has been shown to lower blood pressure.
The NIH Senior Health website was jointly developed by the National Institute on Aging and the National Library of Medicine for older adults and their families. Once again, the website is www.nihseniorhealth.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
When we come back, we'll greet our new special correspondent, Cherry Graziosi, as she sits down for a chat with one of the top researchers at the National Cancer Institute. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio.
No doubt about it, you're on your way to the top. You're young, you've got the education, you've got the talent. So what's the harm in a little celebrating? I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
Come on, tough guy, chug it. Be a man.
Chug, 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 chug.
You are under arrest for disorderly conduct. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you.
Please step out of the car, sir. I'm now going to proceed with a field sobriety test.
What could possibly go wrong? Plenty. That's what. The path to success is tough enough for young adults. Why make it even tougher? If alcohol is a problem for you or someone you know, visit www.niaaa.nih.gov for more information. Brought to you by this station and the National Institutes of Health, an agency of the United States Department of Health and Human Services.
And now we welcome our new special correspondent, Cherry Graziosi, who has taken the traveling microphone to the clinical center to get the lowdown on some of the latest efforts to prevent and cure cancer in children. It's all yours, Cherry.
Thanks, Bill. I'm here with Dr. Crystal Makel, who is the chief of the immunology section and acting branch chief of the pediatric oncology branch of the National Cancer Institute. Is that right?
That's right.
That is a mouthful, and I appreciate you joining us today and talking a little bit about pediatric oncology and a little bit about this new research that you've been doing. But first, I always like to ask doctors when I interview them why they choose the area that they pick for their practice. And you've picked pediatric oncology.
Well, you know, I think there is nothing so troubling to a physician than to see someone in the prime of their life being struck down with cancer. So as I went through my training, I saw it as really the greatest challenge to overcome is to try to figure out this nasty disease in terms of how we can improve the survival for its most innocent, youngest victims. Intellectually, it's incredibly rich. What we have learned about pediatric cancer has fed much of the progress in adult cancers. Emotionally, it's very intense. These patients really come to, you know, you develop very strong relationships with your patients. So, you know, for all those reasons, I can't think of anything that's, you know, more worth my time.
Did you know when you were getting into medical school that this was the area of the practice that you wanted to practice?
I knew that cancer was really where I wanted to focus my efforts. Mm-hmm. And then when I spent time with children with cancer, that, you know, that challenge mm-hmm. really was so great that I couldn't really think seriously about anything else. I ended up doing adult medicine, too, during my training, but I really knew that pediatric oncology was really where I wanted to put all of my energy.
I read something yesterday about pediatric patients who have had cancer. The success rate is pretty good, actually. but that these patients go on in their adult life to have more problems, such as other types of cancer, I guess in women, breast cancer. They have heart attacks at younger ages. Is that true?
Yeah, so, you know, the progress we've made in childhood cancer could arguably be considered one of the greatest advances of modern medicine, really since the 60s, where pretty much everybody died who was diagnosed with childhood cancer, till now, where over about, I'd say, 70 to 80% of kids diagnosed with cancer now survive. But, you know, the bittersweet part of that is it comes at a price. And the treatments that the patients have to endure to be cured are sometimes very intense. And that comes with a long-term price. Some of the toxicities are irreversible. There's another element there too, and that is that patients that do get cancer earlier in their life are also perhaps prone to cancer in general. So they are also at risk, perhaps because of their genetic makeup, for secondary cancer. So there's those two elements working against them. That means that they really are going to have a lifelong need to stay very connected medically to stay healthy.
Trying to explain to the parents the medical part and all of this has got to be just as tough as it is trying to explain it to the patients. And I bet you that if I were to tell you that a pediatric patient grows up pretty fast, it's probably true.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the parents do too. There's a loss of innocence. Mm-hmm. I mean, childhood is a period of time that one isn't supposed to be thinking about life and death situations. And as soon as that innocence is removed, then the whole family, their life will never be the same, regardless of the outcome, even if the child is cured. You know, they really do realize how precious life is. Pediatric oncologists do not treat the child only, they treat the whole family. Mm-hmm. And the family gets really an immersion into... Most of them have a minor medical degree by the time they're done with the treatment, because they're participants, both the parents and the child, in the treatment. They don't just listen to what the doctor says and say, okay, doctor. They ask questions and really come to understand.
On this side, you have the parents and the patient. And then on this other side, you have young research fellows who at one time were like you, and you're teaching them too, not only the disease, but the bedside manner to be able to deal with the patients and their families.
Yeah.
How difficult is that?
Well, you know, we have a fellowship-centric program here. We do not have the whole gamut of medical students, interns, residents, which sometimes leads to a cast of thousands and is sometimes, I think, difficult for the patient, perhaps, if there are large numbers of trainees. Here we are basically training fellows. That means individuals that have already been trained in pediatrics. So they're board eligible or board certified in pediatrics, and they are now doing their oncology training. So it's very much a one-on-one apprentice type situation where they watch what you do and they emulate you really as a role model. That's how you learn this business. Mm-hmm. And I think the patients actually appreciate that because they develop relationships with these individuals. Mm-hmm. There aren't so many people that they can't develop relationships. And it really is all about relationships. Mm-hmm. They have to trust you. They have to know that you're looking out for them, that you're, you know, watching every detail to the extent it can be watched. So the training aspects, it adds another element that the patient maybe has to endure. I think that on balance, it's a positive because these young people are very bright and they keep us on our toes.
Your lab, you're working on some promising research involving the child's immune system. Try to help us out and understand what it is you're doing.
We believe that the immune system can be brought along to work with you in the fight against cancer. And up to now, unfortunately, our therapies have primarily knocked out the immune system, and we really haven't paid a lot of attention to how we can rebuild it in a better way. We've typically worried about the immune system as it relates to infection, and of course that's very important, but to be honest, we're pretty good at treating infections in most of our patients. The problem comes in terms of helping that immune system to battle the cancer itself. And we are giving most of our patients chemotherapy that actually kills our immune cells. And so we have to figure out how to use the immune system at the same time we're using these other active agents, these chemotherapies, rather than putting the immune system at a disadvantage, trying to get the immune system at an advantage against the cancer as well. So our goal is to understand what the chemotherapy does to the immune system. And I think we've made a lot of progress in that arena. Now we're working on how can we replenish that immune system more quickly. So once the chemotherapy stops, instead of having a patient whose immune system is weakened, wouldn't it be great if the cancer patient's immune system was strengthened by our therapies as well, so that it would be working against the tumor as well?
So how do you do that?
Well, right now, Our primary approach is by using cell therapies, where we collect cells and give them back to the patient. And that perhaps makes sense scientifically, but ultimately, we realize that that kind of therapy is labor-intensive, it's expensive, it requires the patient to go through procedures, etc. Down the road, what we would hope is that we would have figured out the growth factors that the body would naturally use and be able to give them in doses and in regimens that help that immune system come back with the growth factor therapy. So right now, for instance, our patients get G-CSF frequently. That's a growth factor that helps their neutrophils come back more quickly. And that works pretty well. We can even give a dose of G-CSF now that lasts a month. We don't have anything like that for the lymphocytes. And so we're working on identifying what growth factor could we use to help the lymphocytes come back as quickly as the neutrophils now do.
The NIH Radio News Service did a story not long ago with Dr. Rosenberg about his therapy that he's doing with the cancer cells. And I think the patient population was end-stage melanoma patients. Is this similar to what you're doing or no?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a couple very important similarities and a couple differences. He is using the basic approach, as I mentioned, of taking the cells out, growing them up, and putting them back in. And when it works, it can be a very elegant proof of principle that this kind of approach can work. It's very hard to export that kind of therapy to large numbers of patients. But ultimately, it could get, you know, easier if we figure out what the critical elements are and if we have medicines that can help these things instead of having to grow the cells. One important point in common between his work and mine is we're both trying to understand how the plasticity of the immune system that occurs when the lymphocytes get depleted can be used to an advantage. So as I mentioned, right now our immune system gets left weakened by chemotherapy, but that weakening can provide a window of opportunity when the immune system is more plastic as it tries to replenish itself. And Dr. Rosenberg is trying to use that weakened immune system as a point of beginning. That's where he actually depletes his patient's immune systems before he gives his cells back. So in our case, we're also working with depleted immune systems. Ours are being depleted by the chemotherapy that children get for cancer. Melanoma patients typically don't get that kind of treatment. The other important difference, though, between Dr. Rosenberg's work and mine is melanoma has enjoyed much progress from very elegant studies of the immunology of melanoma. Childhood cancer has not. There aren't as many people working in childhood cancer to understand what the antigens are. So we have, I think, more work to do before we can get to the elegance that the melanoma field has gotten to, just based upon the fundamental understanding that we have for melanoma.
How excited are you by what you've learned in this research that you're doing with the patients and their immune systems after the chemotherapy?
All the elements are there to be able to succeed. There is nothing that I have ever learned about the immunology of cancer that says that we cannot harness the immune responses to treat it. I really never lose my enthusiasm in terms of believing we have something that we can pull out of our hip pocket. I am frustrated, however, by the pace. It takes so long. And even if you do animal studies that work, to translate that into human progress for people, I get very frustrated by that. So while I'm very excited about the concepts and the proof of principle I think is there, it just frustrates me that we can't make progress more quickly.
And why can't we?
I think that the devil is usually in the details. I mean, I always like to use the example of monoclonal antibodies. They were discovered or created, invented in 1975. And when they were invented, the folks that did this won the Nobel Prize. And it was on the cover of Time, and it was supposed to be the magic bullet for cancer. You know, the concept was right, but there were a lot of details to work out. So in the 80s, people had written them off. They said, forget about monoclonal antibodies, they aren't going to work. And there were a small community that persisted in working out the details. And lo and behold, come the late 90s, you've got Herceptin and you've got Rituxan, which are, you know, agents with very little toxicity that are really improving cure rates for lymphoma and breast cancer patients. Mm-hmm. It's because the devil was in the details, and it took 20 years to figure out the details. We tend to want to grab on to the conceptual leaps and say, ha-ha, you know, we've made it. Now, tomorrow, we're going to cure patients. And it just often takes time to work out the details.
What do you think is the biggest unanswered question in cancer research today?
Well, I think identifying the Achilles heel for individual tumors. In other words, most of these tumors have some one or two or three essential pathways that they need. And once you define the essential pathway, you're on top of the tumor. I mean, the perfect example is chronic myelogenous leukemia. We know that there's a translocation in that disease called the Philadelphia chromosome. It's the essential pathway. If you can block that Philadelphia chromosome, The tumor goes, it disappears before your eyes. It really is magical for those of us in the field that struggled with this disease for years and couldn't cure it. You found the Achilles heel and you treated it. The problem is that every tumor is different. And perhaps some tumors have more than one, so that even if you identify one, they're plastic enough to identify another. So for me, it's for each individual tumor identifying that critical, essential pathway that they need to run on.
What can you tell patients, without giving them too much promise, that you see a promising future?
If you just look at the last 10 years, we knew nothing about what the immune system was doing in response to chemotherapy just a few years ago. And in the last 10 years now, we have come to understand a goodly portion of what chemotherapy is doing, a goodly portion of how that immune system resets itself. And we've identified a new drug, a new agent that we think can really accelerate that. 10 years is a long time if you have cancer, but once you kind of lay that groundwork, you know, I think you can see progress over the course of even 1 or 2 years once you have that critical groundwork laid. So I think you will see, you know, tumor vaccines and immunotherapy and bone marrow transplant and all of that really continuing to make progress even in the next 5 years. I guess I'd tell them to keep the hope and, like all of these patients do, make sure you know what's out there.
At the beginning of this interview, we talked about 75 to 80% of pediatric patients are now cured or doing better. Way back when you started, it wasn't like that. So things have, I know it's frustrating that it goes slow.
Absolutely. No, there has been great progress made. We don't rest on our laurels. Once you see a disease fall, which means that disease is cured, you're going to move on to the next one because you treat these patients and you know that there are still patients who really, really do need you to do that.
Dr. Crystal Makel, I thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to keeping up with this research and talking to you more about the progress of it in months to come.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm Cherry Graziosi, and Bill, back to you.
Thanks again, Cherry, and welcome aboard. When we come back, we'll hear how the National Eye Institute is looking for new ways to foil one of the leading causes of blindness. That's next on NIH Research Radio. A key to good health is eating healthy foods. So, when you're dashing around the supermarket, dash to the produce aisle for fresh fruits and vegetables. Dash to the dairy case for low-fat milk products. Dash to the foods that are lower in saturated fat, trans fat, cholesterol, sodium, and added sugars. Dash to the foods that have been proven in the fight against high blood pressure. For more information about the Dash Eating Plan, log on to www.dashplan.org. This message brought to you by the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. A study published 5 years ago showed that high-dose antioxidant vitamins and minerals taken by mouth reduced the risk of progressive vision loss caused by age-related macular degeneration, or AMD, by 19%. Now the National Eye Institute at the National Institutes of Health will look into whether a modified combination of vitamins, minerals, and fish oil can further slow the progression of vision loss due to AMD. Nearly 100 clinical centers nationwide are seeking 4,000 people between the ages of 50 and 85 who currently have AMD, according to Dr. Emily Chu, study chair and deputy director of the Division of Epidemiology and Clinical Research at the NEI.
We're excited about the study. Macular degeneration is the leading cause of visual impairment in the U.S. and probably in the Western civilized world. So if we can do a little bit to reduce the risk, we can go a long way. And it's only going to get worse because we're living longer and not necessarily healthier.
People taking part in the study must be available for yearly eye exams for at least 5 years. For more info, visit the website www.nei.nih.gov or call 877-ARDS-80. That's 877-AREDS-80. It's a debilitating mental health disorder that not only exacts a toll on its victims, their friends and family, but it has an effect on an employer's bottom line, as we hear from Wally Akinso.
It used to be known as manic depression. It's a condition that takes a toll not only on the person who suffers from it, but on the person's workplace. Researchers have shown that bipolar disorders cost employers twice as much in lost productivity as major depressive disorder. According to a study funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, American workers with bipolar disorder averaged 65.5 lost workdays in a year, compared to 27.2 for major depression. Even though major depression is more than six times as prevalent, bipolar disorder costs the U.S. workplace a disproportionately high $14.1 billion annually, according to Dr. Philip Wong, director of the NIMH Division of Services and Intervention Research.
Bipolar disorder can consist of both depressive episodes. It also has episodes of mania or hypomania. What we found is that the episodes of depression that can occur both with major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder, they're more severe and they're more persistent. They last longer in folks who have bipolar disorder. And that accounts for why bipolar disorder leads to greater lost work performance relative to major depression.
The researchers measured the persistence of the disorders by asking respondents how many days during the past year they experienced episodes of mood disorder. They judge the severity based on symptoms during a worse month, factoring in lost workdays due to absence or poor function on the job combined with salary data yielded an estimate of lost productivity. Dr. Wong said episodes related to bipolar disorder are sometimes incorrectly treated as major depressive disorder.
If you only assess someone for depression, in other words, let's say a worker comes in and reports depressive symptoms like low energy, low mood, symptoms like that. If you only assess them for depression, you might miss that the depressive symptoms are actually part of bipolar illness. In that case, clinicians might mistakenly initiate an antidepressant medication, for example. The danger in that situation is that someone who truly has bipolar disorder, if you initiate an antidepressant, it could trigger actually a manic episode. What can be done about that? The clinician should be careful to not just assume that someone who's reporting depressive symptoms has depression. They should also screen for bipolar disorder and make sure that that's not actually the underlying cause of the person's depressive symptoms.
Dr. Wong said since antidepressants can trigger the onset of mania, workplace programs should first rule out the possibility that a depressive episode may be due to bipolar disorder. He added future effectiveness trials could gauge the return on investments for employers offering coordinated evaluations and treatment for both mood disorders. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Americans accustomed to the seasonal misery of sneezing, runny noses, and itchy, watery eyes caused by ragweed pollen may one day benefit from an experimental allergy treatment that not only requires fewer injections than standard immunotherapy, but also leads to a marked reduction in symptoms that persists for at least a year after therapy is stopped. That's the upshot of a study published in the October 5 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. The research was sponsored by the Immune Tolerance Network and funded by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. The study initially involved 25 adult volunteers aged 23 to 69 with a history of seasonal allergic rhinitis, positive skin test reactions to ragweed pollen, and immediate reaction when nasally challenged with ragweed. Dr. Marshall Plout, chief of the Allergic Mechanisms Section in the Division of Allergy, Immunology, and Transplantation at the NIAID, talked about some of the advantages of this investigational treatment.
Well, the major benefit to patients, if this were to be used for ragweed allergy, would be that they would get long-lasting relief with apparently minimal adverse events and get very impressive and long-lasting symptom relief. I mean, that's based on the study with its shortcomings, but if the study proves to be true, that is, if this were really true with a much larger group of patients, and if the safety concerns, which are very hard to evaluate in only 25 people, are confirmed, then those would be the advantages.
Dr. Plout said if these preliminary results are borne out in further larger studies, there could be good news for other types of allergy sufferers as well.
The advantages beyond that are that it gives the thought there may be other approaches to treat diseases for which we currently have no treatment. For example, food allergy, where we don't have an allergy immunotherapy because the likelihood of severe reactions to the injections is much too high to warrant that approach. If this approach proved to be successful in in that situation, then all of a sudden we would have a therapy where now we have nothing to offer patients.
As many as 40 million Americans suffer from seasonal allergies caused by airborne pollens produced by grasses, trees, and weeds. Most are successfully treated with antihistamines or nasal corticosteroids. However, when people with allergies do not respond to these treatments or experience severe symptoms, the next therapeutic option is allergen immunotherapy, a course of subcutaneous injections of the allergen. And with that, we come to the end of another edition of NIH Research Radio. Please join us Friday, November 3rd, when episode 18 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The contact information is right there on the podcast webpage. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.